Hello everyone, JD here with this week's Talking News Update. It's been quite a reflective and an emotional week here at Sight for White. Alongside our usual activities and friendly faces coming through the doors, we recently had the pleasure of celebrating one of our members reaching an incredible milestone, their 90th birthday. It was a lovely occasion filled with smiles, laughter, cake, and so many warm conversations. Moments like that really remind you of how important friendship and community and connection really is. At the same time, it was also particularly meaningful this week as we came together to remember a much-loved member who sadly passed away. We were incredibly grateful to receive a dedicated memorial bench in her honour, which now sits proudly as a place of reflection, conversation and remembrance. Seeing members gather around, sharing stories and memories was genuinely moving. What stood out the most to me this week was the care and the love our members have for one another. The support, kindness and sense of togetherness across our community is something very special, and it was a privilege to witness it. As always, thank you to our amazing volunteers, staff and supporters, members, for continuing to make Sight for White such a welcoming and compassionate place to be. We look forward to seeing many of you out and about over the coming weeks, and as always, I look forward to seeing you all again very soon. Take care.
This week's charity news, 8th of May 2026. Our next hearing cafe is on Monday at Brown's Golf Course, Sandown, between 10:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. This is open to everyone and staff will be on hand to speak to you.
Swimming at Medina is on Monday between 1:15 p.m. and 2 p.m. We have the whole pool, so whether you wish to swim lanes or just have gentle exercise in the pool, you'll be made very welcome. The cost is £6 and transport is available, although limited. All members are very welcome to join.
Tandem biking is now on a Tuesday along the Cow Cycle Track. If you would like to go on a tandem, please do not hesitate to call the office and we can arrange a suitable time.
Yoga will restart on Tuesday, 2nd of June at Millbrook House at 2 p.m. If you'd like to join the group, please call the office and ask for more details. This is a limited number group and a ballot will take place if oversubscribed.
Coffee and Chat is on Wednesday starting at 10 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. The cost is £2 to include drinks and cake. Staff are on hand to help with any queries and to demonstrate equipment.
Mix and Mingle is on Thursday at Millbrook House. This group enjoys crafts, quizzes and entertainment. If you'd like to put your name down on the list, please call the office.
Wet Wheels has once again invited us to go out on their vessel for an exciting ride out on the Solent. The cost is £10 for an around 1 hour 45 minute journey from Cowes Corinthian Yacht Club. The dates are May the 21st and July the 23rd. Please call the office if you wish to go.
We also have trips on the Spirit of Scott Barder available. This is a catamaran and will sail from East Cowes for half a day or full day sailing in the Solent. For more information, please call the office.
We have been invited to the Royal Victoria Yacht Club's Disability Sailing Day on July the 18th between 11 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Spaces are limited, and if oversubscribed, a ballot will be held. Please call the office if you are interested and would like more details.
We have our Apollo Theatre in Newport trip on the 25th of July to watch Seven Girls Seven musical. Tickets are £12.50. Please call the office to reserve a place.
We are busy planning our Christmas in July event on the 4th of July. We are appealing for good bric-a-brac, tombola prizes, jigsaws, books, raffle prizes and any Christmas decorations. If you have any donations, please drop off at Millbrook House, or if you can't, please call the office and we can arrange collection.
This is an urgent appeal to anyone who you may know that could drive our minibus. We're in desperate need for volunteers to drive it, especially on a Thursday afternoon. If you have a neighbour, friend, relation who may be interested, please ask them to call the office and speak to Susan.
Sainsbury's Newport has changed their shop layout following major refurbishment. If anyone would like to book a route familiarisation session with Emma, our trainee mobility officer, please call the office and she will be able to book you in a time.
This is Chris and Brian reading the talking news from Jersey Zoo. An article from Island Echo. Questions raised over transparency of Ride Town Hall purchase plan. An independent partnership which earlier this year unveiled a vision to invest £19.5 million of public money in Ride has again drawn criticism over the future of Ride Theatre, Ride Town Hall. Former Ride Town councillor Simon Cook has said Ride Neighbourhood Board, RNB, was looking to rush through a highly contentious and complex purchase of Ride Town Hall under the cover of an election. He told the Local Democracy Reporting Service, LDRS, the involvement of County Hall staff and a board member who is an election candidate and very publicly associated with the building is a very clear breach of the Isle of Wight Council's own pre-election rules. The Isle of Wight Council, in response, said several points raised will need to be addressed directly by the RNB. The board has been approached for comment, but has yet to respond. Joe Robertson, Isle of Wight East MP and a member of the board, told the LDRS there are council candidates on the board who are pushing a particular agenda around the future of Ride Town Hall. He said RNB should never have proposed to hold politically contentious meetings during the local election campaign, and it is right two meetings have been cancelled late in the day. Mr. Robertson added, however, that at least two have already taken place. An Isle of Wight Council spokesperson said that as an accountable body, it provided advice to officers supporting RNB. RNB subsequently took the decision to postpone the meetings planned for the 1st and 7th of May, they said. Mr. Robertson said the board was proposing to make a decision about the council purchasing the town hall on behalf of the board during an election campaign. The Isle of Wight Council has serious questions to answer for its own role in preparing and supporting these politically contentious meetings using staff who are publicly funded, contrary to the council's own advice and legal obligations during the sensitive election period. Mr. Cook, who is currently a trustee and chair of Ride Town Hall Trust, said many questions arise from the undue haste being taken, where only a few weeks were given to commission and complete a mass of reports for required due diligence. He said, there appears to have been no tendering process or even decisions recorded on appointing consultants, which includes a surveyor who is presented to the board as part of the Ride Revival Group. This appears to be a serious conflict of interest. Ride Revival, a community interest company, was previously reported to be in talks to take control of Ride Town Hall. Mr. Cook said the Grade 2 listed landmark has been allowed to fall into a state of very serious dereliction. He told the LDRS, it is highly concerning that the board was looking to rush through a highly contentious and complex purchase, which could burden the town with multi-million pound liabilities under the cover of an election, with a decision planned on polling day, 7th of May. the involvement of the Isle of Wight Council staff and a board member who is a candidate that is very publicly associated with the building is a very clear breach of the council's own pre-election rules. This, yet again, raises serious questions over the transparency and governance of the board, along with the role of the council as the accountable body.
This is Brian reading an article from the Island Echo. RNLI to shut East Cowes lifeboat factory as production moves to Dorset. The RNLI is to close its East Cowes lifeboat manufacturing operation in a major blow to the Isle of Wight, with all inshore lifeboat production set to transfer to Dorset by the end of 2027. The charity has confirmed that the Inshore Lifeboat Centre, ILC, in East Cowes will cease manufacturing operations following what it describes as a careful consideration of all options and consultation with staff. Island Echo understands that senior charity figures visited the ILC earlier back in October last year. The Island Echo first reported of the plans to close the Inshore Lifeboat Centre after 60 years. Production will instead be consolidated at the RNLI's Life-Saving Support Centre in Poole. The decision marks the end of lifeboat manufacturing on the Isle of Wight and raises fresh concerns over the loss of skilled jobs and specialist marine industry expertise from the island. Opened in 1963, the ILC currently builds and maintains up to 80 boats each year, including the inflatable B-class and D-class lifeboats and lifeguards inshore rescue boats, IRBs, whilst the All-Weather Lifeboat Centre, ALC, in Poole, which was built in 2015, builds the Shannon-class lifeboat and provides repairs and refits to the all-weather lifeboat fleet. Both sites employ highly skilled individuals who deliver world-class lifeboats to our lifeboat crews and lifeguards to carry out their life-saving roles. The ILC is estimated to require more than £5 million in capital investment to remain compliant for legislation on building and testing conditions. In contrast, the ALC is a newer, larger facility with ability to take on the wider manufacturing requirements of the RNLI future fleet. RNLI Chief Engineer and Technical Director Ross Barraclough said, "Use of the sea around the UK is changing. Our data shows 98% of all RNLI rescues are now within 10 nautical miles of the shore, compared to years ago when the demand was further offshore. For us to continue delivering our core purpose of saving lives at sea, the charity needs to evolve and respond to the changing demand placed on our service. Our 2040 lifeboat fleet strategy will determine what is needed to ensure we have the right lifeboats in the right locations to continue saving lives into our third century. My responsibility is to ensure we can build these lifeboats in the most efficient way, adapting our production delivery to make sure we continue to use our supporters' money wisely and operate sustainably. This change in need represents a major shift in demand for our production teams, with an anticipated reduction in production hours by a third. And whilst it is a difficult decision, we need to consider our future footprint and cost base. I fully recognise the dedication, commitment and quality of work by our Inshore Lifeboat Centre team, their professionalism throughout this process and the impact this decision will have not only on them but on the wider RNLI community on the Isle of Wight. Our immediate focus is on supporting colleagues through this period of change and to prioritise helping them find alternative roles and plan their futures. The RNLI is committed to supporting all those impacted throughout this process. Manufacturing at the East Cowes site is expected to continue until the end of 2027 before operations are fully relocated to Dorset."
Channel race decided by just 13 seconds after 20-hour battle from Cowes to France, from the Island Echo, read by Lee. Sailing out of Cowes over the Maybank holiday weekend were yachts undertaking the Cervantes Trophy race. This race was the first in a series of seven races organised by the Royal Ocean Racing Club, RORC. After voyaging across the Channel to Le Havre, France, the overall winner under IRC was decided by just 13 seconds after more than 20 hours of racing. Nicolas Desoutres' Princesse Gotinoud second won overall, just 13 seconds ahead of Nick Martin's Diablo, racing double-handed with Joe Slipper. Sam White's Mzungu, racing fully crewed, was third, only 1 minute 40 seconds behind the winner. Derek Shakespeare's Bulldog was fourth, just 1 minute 54 seconds off the overall win. After a tactical Channel race of light airs and a shift in breeze, the top four were separated by less than 2 minutes on IRC corrected time. However, Greg Lennard's Swift took monohull line honours in the race in an elapsed time of 17 hours, 32 minutes and 28 seconds. First to finish in the IRC fleet was Graham Lewis's Venomous in 17 hours, 54 minutes and 2 seconds. Peter Coote's Slinky Malinky took multi-hole line honours in 18 hours, 51 minutes, 47 seconds and corrected out to win the multi-hole class. Prize giving took place at the Société des Régates de Havre in the SRH, which is France's oldest yacht club and one of the historic homes of cross-channel racing. It was officiated by flag officers from both clubs, SRH Commodore Augustine Saval and Thonios, IRC Commodore Deb Fish and RORC Vice Commodore Derek Shakespeare, supported by the SRH Commission Voila Christophe Lechevet and RORC Racing Manager Chris Jackson. Other races in the series, starting and finishing in Cowes, including Myth of Malham to the Eddiston Lighthouse, and back to Cowes on the 23rd of May, De Quenguin Bull on the 30th of May, and a Channel race on the 25th of July. Further races in the series, which runs until the end of September, start in Cowes, but finish in France.
This is Chris, reading an article from the County Press, and I'm mentioned in it. Olympic champion Dame Kelly Holmes on the Isle of Wight. Double Olympic champion Dame Kelly Holmes made a surprise appearance on the Isle of Wight on Saturday, May the 2nd, joining runners at Tennyson Down for Park Run. The double gold medalist, who famously won the 800 metres and 1,500 metre titles at the Athens 2004 Olympics, travelled to the island early on that morning, catching a 6:50 a.m. ferry from Lymington before heading west to Freshwater. Medina Isle of Wight Park Run had relocated from its usual home at Seacloth Park due to a SCI Youth Football Festival's tournament, with runners instead taking on the challenging Tennyson Down route, a course only used occasionally and known for its demanding hills. Sharing her experience, Dame Kelly described the run as a tough but rewarding challenge. She said, "Early start at 5:30 a.m., then headed to the once every 2 years venue, Tennyson Down. Wow! 146 metre total elevation with a hill right at the start. Where's the down? Oh, at the end." Despite the difficulty, she praised the setting, adding it was a beautiful place to be, and took time to snap a photo at the Tennyson Monument at the top of the course. A few rabbit holes on the way up, but I was not risking it, Dame Kelly added. After completing the 5K run, she stayed to chat with runners and volunteers, posing for photos with participants, marshals, and the event's race director, Chris Amy. Medina Isle of Wight Park Run is a free weekly timed 5K event held every Saturday morning and organised entirely by volunteers. While it is normally based at Seacloth Park in Newport, it occasionally moves to alternative locations such as Apley or Tennyson Down when required. Reflecting on the visit, Dame Kelly said she was chuffed to be still running and enjoying the sport.
This is Brian reading an item from Isle of Wight Radio. Visit Isle of Wight launches industry survey to shape future of Wight bid. Visit Isle of Wight, VIOW, has launched a new industry-wide survey calling on local businesses to share their views on the current Wight Business Improvement District, BID, and help shape plans for its future as work begins on BID3. The Wight BID, established in 2016 and successfully renewed in 2021, has been built on a simple but powerful principle that businesses working together can create a stronger, more influential voice in shaping the future of the Isle of Wight as a leading visitor destination. Each year, the Wight BID generates more than £500,000 in levy funding, complemented by an additional £300,000 through strategic partnerships with Red Funnel, Whitelink and Southern Vectis, alongside further income from advertising opportunities. These combined resources support a wide range of destination marketing, business support initiatives and operational delivery led by VIOW. As bids are required to renew their mandate every 5 years, preparations are now underway for the next renewal ballot, scheduled for October 2026. With a newly elected board of directors in place since November 2025 and a new CEO appointed in February 2026, this marks a pivotal moment for the organisation and the wider business community. VIOW is now inviting all levy-paying and eligible businesses to take part in the survey, which will play a crucial role in informing the development of BID3. Feedback gathered will directly influence priorities, investment decisions, and the overall business plan for the next five-year term. Dominic Ray, CEO of Visit Isle of Wight, said, "This is a key moment for our business community. The success of the Wight BID has always been rooted in collaboration. And as we look ahead to BID3, it's vital that we hear directly from the businesses it represents. Your feedback will help shape the future direction of investment, ensuring it reflects the needs and ambitions of the island's tourism and wider business economy. The survey provides an opportunity for businesses to reflect on the impact of the current BID, highlight what is working well, and identify areas where greater support or new initiatives may be needed to drive growth and resilience across the island's visitor economy. All background information, including previous Wight BID progress reports, is available online at visitwhitepro.com. Businesses are encouraged to complete the questionnaire by midday on Monday the 15th of June. Visit Isle of Wight is urging all eligible businesses to take a few minutes to have their say and help shape the next chapter of the Wight BID. Wight BID members can access the survey online.
Good morning, I'm John.
And I'm Susan.
Now we have the news items. Backlash on ill-conceived outdoor gym at attraction by Rufus Pickles. An ill-conceived new outdoor gym and waste of money wooden fence, which ruins the view at Fort Victoria Country Park, has triggered a backlash from residents. Lip service was paid to the public, a meeting heard on Wednesday, with frustration aired over a lack of consultation, as well as fears around vandalism, litter and health and safety. The play fitness equipment was put in place at the weekend, and according to the council, will be suitable for younger and older children, with wooden materials chosen to be consistent with its surroundings. Outgoing ward councillor Peter Spink, who is not standing for re-election, told attendees there was very little advance notice of what was to take place, with no meaningful consultation. One member of the public said, "The expected good manners is for some form of consultation, which never transpired. Therefore, they paid lip service to us, the public who live here." Another attendee questioned whether there would be an increased litter management during the school holidays, adding that she litter picks frequently there. She also asked whether there is a budget to keep equipment in good order if it gets vandalised or damaged. Another resident described the gym as an ill-conceived idea, saying it's not needed at all. Another voiced concern over a lack of soft surface and said at this time of year the ground is like concrete. He said it's not for children, adding it's equipment for adolescents, older adolescents and for adults. The instructions on the side are all pictures of adults. There was also criticism of a wooden fence along the sea wall, completed a short time before the gym installation. A woman told the meeting, "There's no need for the fence right the way around. It ruins the view. It's a waste of money. It doesn't stop dogs getting in. People can climb through it. It's just not serving a purpose at all." An Isle of Wight Council spokesperson said in a statement, "The council remains committed to enhancing public spaces and managing coastal risk responsibly. A trim trail with 5 activities and an outdoor fitness zone has been installed, providing dedicated spaces for younger and older children to support fitness for all ages. The wooden equipment reflects the country park theme, and the larger fitness zone has been deliberately positioned in the shade of the tree line. Small-scale public realm assets are installed under the council's delegated authority framework in accordance with the constitution, enabling operational teams to deliver approved programs efficiently without formal committee decisions. The Fort Victoria works were referenced in weekly updates issued to parish and town councils between February 11th and May the 5th, including notifications about fencing and playground equipment. Going forward, ward members will be added to the distribution. The works were also discussed through the West Wight multi-parish engagement meetings, which are formally scheduled, accessible in person and online, and supported by circulated minutes. It is recognised that local awareness was lower than intended, and further steps are being taken to improve the visibility of scheme-specific information. The wooden fencing is separate from the play and fitness equipment and was installed as a health and safety measure. A coastal inspection identified defects in the seawall, including voiding, erosion and localised instability. A review of the fencing identified sections that extend beyond what is required to protect visitors. Sections to the north, where the seawall is in better condition, and to the west, where there is open grassland, will be removed. These works will be undertaken imminently. County Hall offered to hold an engagement meeting on the subject.
Terror threat reassurance. A police commissioner has offered reassurance to the public following a rise in the UK's national terror threat level. The alert was raised to severe following a stabbing in North London on Wednesday, April the 29th. Hampshire and Isle of Wight Police and Crime Commissioner Donna Jones said, "I understand that any increase in the national threat level can feel worrying, and I want to reassure people across Hampshire and the Isle of Wight that this decision has been taken as a precautionary measure to keep community safe. The safety of everyone who lives, works and visits our area is my absolute priority. I am in regular contact with the Chief Constable and fully support the enhanced police patrols you will see, particularly around places of worship and other public spaces. I want to be very clear in saying to our Jewish communities and all those who may feel anxious as a result of this announcement, you are valued, you are supported, and you are not alone. If you have concerns, please speak to a police officer or reach out to local support organisations. Reporting suspicious behaviour really does make a difference, and I encourage everyone to remain alert."
Rowers to carry a 12-foot oar across Isle of Wight for walk by William Dalgleish. It's that special time of the year again when popular fundraiser Walk the Wight will bring thousands together for a common goal. Mountbatten Isle of Wight's flagship fundraising event returns this weekend. On Sunday, thousands of islanders will once again walk in memory of loved ones, raise funds, or simply enjoy the countryside with friends and family. Walkers will participate in either the full 26.5-mile route from Bembridge to Alum Bay, a half route, a school's walk, the 8-mile flat walk, or go their own way at a time and place of their choosing. Walk the Wight was founded in 1991 by Bill Bradley and Frank Stevens. This year marks the 36th anniversary of the fundraising event, which originally began as a company team-building exercise. It has grown into one of the island's largest community events, raising more than $500,000 each year for the charity. Mountbatten's compassionate staff provide 24/7 support to more than 2,500 people every single day. 12 rowers from Yarmouth Gig Rowing Club will take on the Walk the Wight Challenge, carrying a heavy gig oar measuring 12 foot. The idea began as a joke during a training session, but soon became a serious plan, with each pair of rowers carrying the heavy gig oar on their shoulders for 20-minute intervals throughout the route. Keith Campbell, chairman of Yarmouth Gig Rowing Club, said, "Walk the Wight has always captured people's imagination, and as a club based in Yarmouth, we are delighted to not only take part with this slightly off-the-wall challenge, but also have the opportunity to try and put something back into something that is so important to our island community. The team will set off from Bembridge at 6 a.m, having raised more than £1,300 so far."
Substance believed to be poison. Isle of Wight Police have renewed their warning for dog walkers in Parkhurst Forest after collecting multiple samples of a substance believed to be rat poison. Officers have received a number of reports since February of dogs falling ill after ingesting a substance in the forest, following similar reports in previous years. The force said it has collected samples of a substance and is confident it is rat poison, which has been left throughout the forest. Dog walkers have reported encountering a substance at the Mark's Corner end of Parkhurst Forest, but police said it could be laid anywhere. Sergeant Mark Radford said, "These incidents continue to cause concern to people who use the forest, But most important of all is the harm this is causing to people's beloved pets. This is simply unacceptable. Our officers are patrolling the area and following up any available lines of inquiry. Please be alert and mindful of your surroundings to help keep yourself, your pet and others safe.
Woman used dead friend's blue badge by court reporter. A well-known charity fundraiser has been convicted of fraud after she was caught using her dead friend's blue badge to park. Sarah Tyrrell Jones of Fitzroy Street, Sandown, appeared at the Isle of Wight Magistrates Court on Tuesday, May the 5th. She admitted one count of fraud by false misrepresentation. The court heard how, on August 22nd last year, the 51-year-old parked in a disabled bay at Lugley Street car park, Newport. A blue badge belonging to her friend, who was also her husband's stepfather, was on display on the dashboard. Checks showed the man died on May 30th, 2025. Court heard how Mrs. Tyrrell Jones previously had a blue badge for her son, who is autistic and non-verbal, but this had expired and an attempt to reapply was rejected as it no longer met the criteria. When questioned, she said she knew she should not have used the other badge. Defending Tom Cook said Mrs. Tyrrell Jones was taking her son to Clark's for new shoes ahead of the new school term. In the car he was sick and was having a meltdown. Mrs. Tyrrell Jones acted on autopilot and used the other badge on her Suzuki. The court also heard a separate penalty charge was issued for parking on a double yellow line 3 days prior. Mr. Cook said Mrs. Tyrrell Jones knows she did a stupid thing and that she should not have done it. He said she is a previous good character and spends most of her time helping and thinking of others, not herself. Mrs. Tyrrell Jones has previously raised £56,000 for breast cancer awareness, he said. Magistrates said it was a silly thing to do. They ordered Mrs. Tyrrell Jones to pay a total of £432.
Late night services in a flexibility bid. Red Funnel has launched a charter service for late night Red Jet services to the Isle of Wight to add flexibility for those travelling to late night events. The ferry firm will charter sailings in advance and tickets will be made available to the public online. The first late night sailing under the new service is timetabled for Saturday, May the 23rd, with a midnight departure from Southampton. Services will be placed depending on demand and operational availability, and the company also inviting inquiries for future late night sailings. Neil Chapman, Operations Director at Red Funnel, said, "We already operate late night sailings around major events, and this charter gives us more flexibility to increase frequency where it is needed." Richard Quigley, MP for Isle of Wight West, said, "I'm really pleased to have worked with Red Funnel to get this over the line, and I look forward to seeing how the charter service progresses."
Headache on horizon with closure of road for works by Liam Chorley. Another traffic headache is on the horizon, with a section of the main road through Hale Common set to close for works next month. Improvements will be carried out on the A3056 at Hale Common, Arrowton, as part of a wider Department for Transport funded Safer Roads project. It will see the installation of footways between the junction of Watery Lane and the existing bus stop. The aim is to enhance pedestrian safety along the busy road, and the works will include the installation of uncontrolled pedestrian crossing points. The improvements will be delivered in two phases, with phase one bringing about the removal of an existing traffic island on the A3056, to replace it with a pedestrian refuge. The traffic island is located just northwest of the junction of the 3056 with Watery Lane near Newchurch. It will mean a section of the A3056 near the traffic island will be closed for 3 days, from May 13th to May 15th, between 9:30 a.m. and 3:30 p.m., with temporary traffic signals in place at all other times. Motorists will have to divert through Arrowton, Blackwater, Rookley, God's Hill, Whiteley Bank and Apps Heath. During the closure hours, premises northwest of the traffic island, including the Fighting Cocks and Isle of Wight Tomatoes, will only be accessible via Arrowton. Phase 2 of the project will then see the construction of the associated footways under temporary traffic signals between June 1st to July 24th. Throughout the duration of the works, access to all residential and business properties will be maintained, with the traffic signals being removed for the Isle of Wight Festival weekend, when thousands more people will be on the island. For local residents, if the works coincide with your usual domestic waste collection day, you should ensure your waste is on the curbside before 7 a.m. to enable its collection, or contact your service provider to make alternative arrangements. Wherever possible, access to bus stops will be maintained, and where this is not feasible, a temporary alternative bus stop will be provided.
Inquest opens into death of rugby player after crash. An inquest has been opened into the death of much-loved rugby player Tristan Price, who died in a crash near Whitwell in January. The inquest into the death of the 45-year-old man from Ventnor was opened at the Isle of Wight Coroner's Court on Friday, May the 1st. The court heard Mr. Price died following a single vehicle collision at the junction of Roud Road and Whitwell Road on Saturday, January the 3rd. Police, paramedics and fire crews were called to the scene, where CPR was administrated, but attempts to save him were unsuccessful and he was pronounced dead at the scene. A post-mortem examination carried out on January the 15th found Mr. Price died from a severe head injury. The coroner listed a provisional full inquest hearing for the 28th of October. Mr. Price was a familiar figure across the island, both through his work as a door supervisor and his long association with Ventnor Rugby Club. He worked as a doorman for executive command and was described by the security company as a huge part of our security family and probably the best known doorman in Newport, and with good reason. Away from work, Mr. Price, affectionately nicknamed Beast, was a stalwart at Ventnor Rugby Club, where he played for 29 years. The club said he was far more than just a player. He was a constant presence, a familiar face, a true club man in every sense, whose commitment, character, unmistakable personality would always be part of Ventnor Rugby Club. In tributes shared following his death, the club described him as someone who gave his all on the pitch and was a friend to everyone off it, adding that thoughts were with his family, friends and everyone who had known him. In the days after the crash, the island rugby community and wider public rallied around Mr. Price's family. Ventnor Rugby Club set up a GoFundMe appeal to help with immediate funeral and memorial costs, with organisers saying any additional funds raised would be placed into a junior ISA for his young daughter.
Olympic Champ at Park Run by Zach Saunders. Double Olympic champion Dame Kelly Holmes made a surprise appearance on the Isle of Wight on Saturday, joining runners at Tennyson Down for Park Run. The double gold medalist, who famously won the 800-metre and 1500-metre titles at the Athens 2004 Olympics, travelled to the island early in the morning, catching a 6:50 a.m. ferry from Lymington, before heading west to Freshwater. Medina Isle of Wight Park Run had relocated from its usual home at Sea Close Park due to a SCI Youth Football Festivals tournament, with runners instead taking on the challenging Tennyson Down route, a course only used occasionally and known for its demanding hills. Sharing her experience, Dame Kelly described the run as a tough but rewarding challenge. She said, "Early start, 5:30 a.m., then headed to the once every 2 years venue, Tennyson Down. Wow, 146 metre total elevation with a hill right at the start. Where's the down? Oh, at the end." Despite the difficulty, she praised the setting, adding it was a beautiful place to be, and took time to snap a photo at the Tennyson Monument at the top of the course. "A few rabbit holes on the way up, and I was not risking it," Dame Kelly added. After completing the 5 kilometres, she stayed to chat with runners and volunteers, posing for photos with participants, marshals, and the event's race director, Chris Amy. Medina Isle of Wight Park Run is a free, weekly, timed 5 kilometres event held every Saturday morning and organised entirely by volunteers. While it is normally based at Sea Close Park in Newport, it occasionally moves to alternative locations, such as Apley or Tennyson Down, when required. Reflecting on the visit, Dame Kelly said she was chuffed to still be running and enjoying the sport.
Duchess of Gloucester opens St Mary's facility. The Duchess of Gloucester visited the Isle of Wight last Friday to officially open a new facility at St Mary's Hospital. Her Royal Highness toured the Isle of Wight NHS Trust Community Diagnostic Centre, which opened at the end of 2024. The centre has already delivered activities to the equivalent of around 88% of the island's population in its first year of operation. The Duchess met staff and heard how the centre is supporting faster diagnosis and reducing the need for residents to travel to the mainland for care. Michelle Stanley, Chief Strategic Officer at the Trust, said, "We were honoured to welcome the Duchess of Gloucester to officially open our new community diagnostic centre. This is a milestone for healthcare on the island. The centre is already helping people access quicker tests and diagnosis closer to home. And the level of activity we have seen reflects just how important this service is for our community." The Duchess also visited the Trust's emergency department, including the Children's Emergency Department, which has been designed to better meet the needs of young people and families.
Beaches where dogs can walk year-round. Dog walking restrictions have come into effect on some beaches on the Isle of Wight. From May 1st to September 30th, dogs are prohibited in specific areas of beaches in Colwell, Cowes, East Cowes, Freshwater Bay, Gurnard, Sandown, Shanklin, Springvale, Ventnor, Yaverland and Ryde. This is enforced by a Public Space Protection Order, PSPO. Maps of these exclusion zones are available on the Isle of Wight Council website, and signage is present to guide pet owners. However, there are 14 beaches where dogs are welcome all year round, offering plenty of space for pooches and their owners to enjoy the sand and sea. In Yaverland, dogs can roam freely to the east of the car park. Ryde Beach, west of the pier, and Apley, east of Apley Tower, also welcome dogs. Seagrove Beach offers quieter outer sections that remain dog-friendly all year round. Wycliffe Bay and Priory Bay offer remote and peaceful settings. Bembridge Beach, with its pebbly shoreline and rock pools, provides a calm environment for exploration. Chiltern Chine, a hidden beach reached by woodland paths, remains quiet even during peak season. The other beaches are Colwell Bay, east of the slipway, Topland Bay, Atherfield Bay, Brook Bay, Rock and End, Steep Hill Cove, and Bonchurch.
Care home transfer hastened mother's death. A grieving son whose mother died within an hour of being transferred from one care home to another believes the move hastened her death and has blasted the Isle of Wight Council for the absolutely appalling way it was handled. Paul Cox, 62, from East Cowes, said he did not find out his mother Catherine Cox, 91, was being taken from Cameron House Ride to Autumn House Sandown until she was already en route. He described the council's approach before and after her death as totally unsympathetic and a disgrace. Catherine, who had dementia and terminal cancer, lived at Cameron House over the past year. At the end of March, it was announced the home would be one of three to shut due to the collapse of the provider. Last week, with just 24 hours' notice, the council was told the homes would be closing on Wednesday, April the 22nd, leading to a frantic scramble to find alternative provision. Paul said he heard nothing from the council and only discovered his mum was being moved from after a call from Cameron House when she was already in an ambulance on her way to Sandown. I then rang adult social care and said, "What do you think you're doing? This will probably kill her." There was no empathy from them whatsoever. They said it had been thrust upon them. They had a month. They should have been finding places for people. Paul went straight to Autumn House with his sister, but within 20 minutes of them arriving, Catherine died with the pair holding her. Although Paul was already fearing the worst due to her fragility, he thinks the move hastened it along. Yes, she might have only lasted a few more days, but I think this journey did it for her, he said. There was absolutely no way she should have been transported to another care home. Following her death, Paul said he had no contact from adult social care with any apology or condolences. He said he felt compelled to tell his mother's story after he read the council statement in the county press. "They're going on about how sad they are and how deeply affected them," he said, and after reading the statement, put out to the media. "I'm totally offended by what they have said. The reality is they could not care less. It's disgraceful." Paul said he has nothing but praise for the staff at Cameron House who lined the pavement and were in tears following the care home's closure. He said he is also sad to hear of the residents who have moved to the mainland. Paul said his mum, who was born in Cheltenham and had four children, lived in a good long life and will be fondly remembered. And Isle of Wight Council spokesperson said, "We are deeply sorry for the distress and grief Mr. Cox has experienced following the death of his mother, Catherine Cox. Our thoughts are with him and his family at this very difficult time. No words can take away the pain of such a loss, though it is not appropriate for us to comment on the specific circumstances of an individual. We recognise the strength of feeling Mr. Cox has expressed."
Three records in Ultra Challenge by Zach Saunders. Last weekend, thousands of walkers, joggers and runners took on the Isle of Wight Ultra Challenge 2026, a demanding endurance test along the island's coastline. Participants set off from the main base camp at Chale to tackle distances ranging from a 10-mile taster event to the full 107-kilometre circumnavigation route. The course led challengers along clifftops and countryside paths, offering both striking views and punishing terrain. Part of a nationwide series of fundraising endurance events, the challenge attracted people of all ages and abilities. Many took part in support of charities, sporting colourful team kits and T-shirts as they progressed around the island at their own pace. Organisers provided regular rest stops, stocked with hot drinks, snacks and medical support, while larger hubs offered hot meals and shelter from the changeable weekend weather. Footage shared on social media captured long streams of competitors winding along the coastline, spurred on by volunteers, friends and family positioned along the route. At the front of the field, four ultra trailblazers delivered standout performances, with three course records falling over the weekend. Ian Jones claimed overall victory in the full 107-kilometre event, finishing in a remarkable 9 hours, 23 minutes and 45 seconds. Maintaining an average pace of just over 5 minutes per kilometre, digging deep over the final stretch to pull clear of the existing course record. Ella Coker produced one of the most impressive performances of the event, finishing second overall and cutting nearly 2 hours off the previous women's 100-kilometre record. In the 50-kilometre category, Natasha Colebrook led the women's field home, while Brian Wilkins secured a hard-fought victory in the men's race, just weeks after narrowly missing out on top spot at the Windsor 50. All four winners were awarded trophies, with Ian, Ella and Brian sharing a £500 prize pot for breaking records and earning free entry into another event in the Ultra Challenge series.
NHS profits leak to private firms. A total of £45.6 million has leaked out in profits from the NHS in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight to private companies over the past 2 years, enough to pay for an extra 260 doctors. Out of the £362 million spent by the NHS on private companies over the 2 years, £45.6 million has leaked out in profits, the seventh highest amount for all 42 integrated care boards. These are the findings of the Centre for Health and Public Interest, CHPI, an independent think tank which aims to ensure the founding principles of the NHS are at the heart of how health and social care services are delivered. David Rowland, director of CHPI, said, "Given the massive pressures faced by the NHS in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, the large amounts of profit which is leaking out of the NHS to private companies urgently needs to be looked at, both by central government and local NHS leaders. A sum of £45.6 million could go towards frontline patient care and would be enough to pay for an extra 260 doctors or 550 nurses over a 2-year period," the CHPI said. Its research finds large profits being generated despite the NHS in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight facing huge financial pressures and recently reporting a £76 million deficit. The figures come from a wider study which finds £1.6 billion has leaked out in profits from NHS budgets across all 42 ICBs and NHS England over the last 2 years. A profit cap of 8% on companies used by the NHS would have saved £656 million over the period, according to the think tank. The CHPI has also pointed to the local NHS being increasingly reliant on companies ultimately owned overseas. The fourth highest ICB in England for spending on companies registered in tax havens. Out of the £362 million spent by the NHS in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight on private sector over the 2 years, £66.7 million was spent on companies whose ultimate owners are based outside the UK. From this, £22.7 million went to companies whose owners are based in tax havens. In addition, the think tank flagged millions of pounds of scarce NHS resources in the region being used to pay interest on high-cost private sector debt. The NHS in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight is increasingly reliant on companies owned by private equity investors. These types of companies tend to be saddled with very large amounts of high-cost debt, the CHPI said. To pay interest on these loans, they use the income they receive from the NHS. The CHPI research shows that over the course of the past 2 years, 10.6 million of NHS spending in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight went towards paying interest on private sector debt. Several recommendations for government are being put forward by the think tank in light of its findings. These include a cap on the profits of companies with an NHS contract, a limit on the amount of debt held by a private company with an NHS contract, and full transparency above where money going to private companies ends up. Finally, the CHPI is calling for requirements for all companies providing NHS services to be tax registered in the UK. James Lau, Chief Commissioning Officer for NHS Hampshire and Isle of Wight, said, in response, "Our priority is to ensure patients receive timely, high-quality care. Like NHS systems across England, we work with a range of providers, including NHS organisations, voluntary sector partners and independent providers, to increase capacity, reduce waiting times and improve access to services. The use of independent sector providers forms part of the national NHS approach to patient choice. Providers must meet strict accreditation requirements to be included, and patients can then choose where they receive their care. Where patients choose an independent provider, services are typically delivered at national set prices, ensuring consistency and value for money across the system."
New appointment for Ireland College by William Dalgleish. Cowes Enterprise College has announced the appointment of a new executive principal. Paul Slaughter will take up the role this September, bringing with him experience from having served as principal at Ormiston Six Villages Academy in Chichester. He will lead both schools as executive principal, providing strategic leadership. Mr. Slaughter said, "I'm delighted to be taking on the role of executive principal at Cowes Enterprise College and to be working more closely with the school. There is a strong team in place and a clear commitment to ensuring the best outcomes for students. I'm looking forward to working with staff, students and families to build on this and continue the positive momentum at the school." During his time at Six Villages Academy, Mr. Slaughter guided the school through significant improvement across all areas. He focused on raising academic standards while also strengthening pastoral care. Vicky Wells, Vice Principal, will continue to lead Cowes Enterprise College through the summer term to ensure a smooth transition. The Trust will soon begin searching for a new head of school, with the aim of making an appointment by September. The leadership change follows the departure of long-standing principal Rachel Kitley, who took up a new role with Ofsted in April. Paul Hyde, Education Director for the West Region at Ormiston Academies Trust, said, "Paul is a highly experienced and respected leader, and we're delighted to appoint him as executive principal. The school is in a strong position with a committed leadership team and clear support from the Trust. We would like to thank Vicky Wells and colleagues for their ongoing work to ensure continuity and a positive experience for students. We are confident that with Paul's leadership, The school will continue to build on its strengths and deliver the best possible outcomes for its community.
And now we move on to White Memories and Nostalgia. Tales of soldiers shot by mistake. During the war, 12 soldiers, possibly more, were shot and killed on the Isle of Wight, not by Germans, but by other British soldiers in a series of careless mistakes. The first county press report appeared in late June 1940, when 23-year-old Private Alfred Peters died from a sentry's shot which passed through four seats of a bus before wounding him. The sentry said the trigger was caught by his finger. He was accustomed to a different type of rifle with a safety catch on the opposite side. The coroner returned a verdict of accidental death. 2 weeks later, another two soldiers were shot, the coroner describing the actions of one of the soldiers who had shot his comrade as a little careless. Sapper Douglas Harvey said he was cleaning a rifle and not knowing it was loaded, he pressed the trigger. There was a bang, and Lance Corporal William Miller, a married man with two children, fell. The coroner attached no blame to Harvey. The coroner then heard the case of Private Dyer, married just a month. Fusilier George Turner was a guard, and Dyer challenged him in fun. Witness unslung his own rifle, also in fun, and half aimed at Dyer. There was a report, and Dyer fell. The coroner commented, "It was a very easy to make a mistake with an automatic action. Turner had been a little careless, but I do not consider it a criminal carelessness." In August 1940, a civilian was shot by a soldier. The county press reported, "Haven Street cowman Frank Sparshot, 42, was seen mounting a bicycle late one night, and a soldier called on him several times to stop, but he did not do so. He ran after the man, whom he stopped by a sentry. Asked why he did not stop, deceased made no reply. The explanation was quite simple. Frank Sparshot was deaf. While deceased's identity card was being examined, PTE Douglas's rifle went off and Sparshot fell to the ground. Douglas could give no explanation for his rifle going off. By Mr. Palmer, there were four men standing round with your rifle pointing towards his head and another man with a bayonet. He couldn't go far with four men standing round him. Do you think it was necessary to point the rifle at his head? Yes."
The jury returned a verdict of death by misadventure, but this time added, "We are rather alarmed at these unfortunate incidents which keep recurring." And recur they did. Four more soldiers were shot during 1941. The first died in February when a corporal, who had found a Tommy gun left at a post, took it into the room he shared with the deceased without checking whether it was loaded. As he closed the door, it went off, shooting deceased in the head. 2 weeks later, the CP reported Corporal Thomas Phillips, aged 20, died after being shot by a comrade. Some joking remarks were passed, and Fusilier Robert Williams picked up a rifle, aimed it, and pressed the trigger. Phillips fell to the ground. The jury said it was not right that these boys should be allowed to play with loaded rifles. In July, Lance Corporal Duke was shot through the head by a comrade. Fusilier Pritchard accidentally discharged a rifle and the bullet passed through Duke's head, killing him instantly. Pritchard said, "I had the wrong rifle." In September, Fusilier Stanley Cox went on guard with Fusilier Dexter. Dexter gave some shots with his unloaded rifle. Witness pressed the trigger of his rifle, expecting nothing to happen, but it was loaded and the bullet went through Dexter's head. The jury found death was due to a regrettable accident that should have been avoided. Four soldiers died in 1942. Private Leonard Theobald died after being shot by a Bren gun. And in March, Gunner Joseph Clark, 35, died from a bullet wound received during rifle practice. He was marking targets when a colleague opened fire prematurely. In June, Corporal Edward Bowles said he fired at three tins during practice, and then, thinking he saw another, he swung round and fired, shooting Sergeant Tost in the head. In August, Lance Bombardier Staines stated he examined a Tommy gun and handed it over to Gunner Jarrett. Shortly afterwards, he heard a shot, and Gunner Horace Shambrook, aged 20, staggered in, holding his stomach with his hands, saying, "He's shot me," and collapsed. The coroner pointed out that it was clear Gunner Jarrett had no idea how to operate a machine gun. Next month's article tells the story of the most shocking death to occur, the coroner stating, "The men completely lost their heads and fired their guns in a most dangerous manner. They simply blasted away in a public place."
Special High School Reunion. A special high school reunion event, a 50th anniversary celebration of the opening of the school, is planned for later this year. Former Medina High School student John Goldsmith is organising the event, marking 50 years since the school first opened back in 1976. The anniversary celebration evening is heading to Gigi's Bar and Restaurant on the outskirts of Newport on July the 11th. An open evening at Medina College is also fixed for Friday, July the 10th, and the school will remain open the following morning, Saturday, for ex-pupils, staff and anyone else keen to have a look around. The evening will feature live music and there will be plenty of food, reminiscing and a charity fundraiser. Ex-pupils and staff from every year group are welcome to attend. I was at Medina from 1980 to 1983 in a class of very clever, talented individuals, myself not included, said John. I loved PE and games with Mark Webber, John Penfield and Fred Isaacs. James Archer was our headmaster and was scary. The year head was Derek Groves and the deputy head was John Barnes. I have lots of happy memories of my time there, but struggled academically. Memories of the Metro, Mr. Turnan, the geography teacher, saying participation a lot and not understanding anything history teacher Crispin Keith wanted. About the event, he said, "Numbers are growing. Thank you all for those who have named charities we could raise money for on the evening. If you have any questions or further ideas, please message me privately, and if anyone wants to help organise the evening, please let me know. Anyone interested in attending should contact John Goldsmith, email jgpompey@yahoo.co.uk.
Days gone by. The county press has been bringing the news to islanders since 1884. We've delved into the archives. 125 years ago, in May 1901, five officers and 154 men forming the Active Service section of the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Artillery Militia left Sandown Barracks for Southampton, where they joined the Orotava and proceeded to South Africa. The annual meeting of the Isle of Wight branch of the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children was held in Shanklin. The branch reported that money from its funds was depleted due to the amount of cases it took before magistrates. 100 years ago, in May 1926, a recommendation to rent a stall at Sandown Pier to a palm reader was granted by Sandown Urban District Council. Madame Zio of Ventnor was offered the use of one of the alcoves at Sandown Pier, despite the fact that five members of the council felt that palm reading was a form of witchcraft and contrary to the scriptures. The approval was given by only one vote. A number of island businesses dropped their prices to help islanders make ends meet during the general strike. And a man was found with his head through a broken pub door in Newport after being asked to leave.
75 years ago, in May 1951, the right of the Southern Electricity Board to increase the charge for street lighting after estimates had been made and the rates fixed was challenged by Freshwater Parish Council. A number of historic buildings in the Ventnor area were listed under the Town and Country Planning Act. Amongst those were the Bond Church and St Lawrence Old Churches, St Catherine's Church, East Dean House, the Crab and Lobster Hotel, and the Old Manor House and Wolverton Manor. 50 years ago, in May 1976, sixth formers Anne Davis and Miranda Court won a sightseeing tour of the cultural centres of Europe in an essay competition run by Barclays Bank. Another round of fare increases were being sought by Southern Vectors. The revised scale of fare increases ranged from 1p to 7p. And finally, the people of Wroxall were celebrating after news broke that the Department of Education and Science was to grant £12,500 towards the building of a community centre in the village. The Isle of Wight County Council also granted £6,250 towards the project.
We now have, in my view, admiration for anyone who goes up for election by Richard Quigley, Member of Parliament for Isle of Wight West. With the results of the local elections now in, I hope that our newly elected and re-elected councillors will do what they were elected to do, support their residents and work as one council for the good of the island. I admire anyone that puts themselves forward in an election to serve their community, because that's what it's all about. But it isn't easy, and none of us are perfect. That's why it's just as important in these febrile times that we remember that politicians are people too. Some are idealistic, others pragmatic, and some are certainly naive. But in my experience, the majority of elected representatives, regardless of party, are good people trying to do their best for the communities they serve. And that's the important bit. That's why it was disappointing to see so much focus was put on national, even international, issues in the run-up to the locals, when the real focus should have been on what's happening locally and what we can do better as an island. Take one headline published during election period that stated over £500,000 was claimed in allowances by Isle of Wight councillors, accompanied by headshots of those individuals, akin to something you'd expect to see on a wanted poster. It's safe to say it caught people's attention, but it also created unnecessary hostility towards more than one of those mentioned, and fuels even greater distrust in politicians. Now, if you switch that headline to councillors claim less than minimum wage over a 3-year period, it might not get as many clicks, but you'd probably see a shift in public attitudes. And it would arguably help better inform the public of the realities of local politics. It certainly isn't the lavish life the media would have you believe. So, by politics and politicians being used more and more as clickbait, we're all losing out, and democracy is all the worse for it. We also wouldn't accept the level of abuse politicians face online if it occurred in real life. So it's important we call it out and stop normalising it. Politicians shouldn't automatically get an easy ride, but I'd encourage everyone to look at how they can help contribute to where they live rather than talk it down, and that applies to journalists too. Only last week, the school's minister visited the island and was blown away by the leadership and passion here. There are some brilliant projects being led by incredibly talented and selfless people in the community too. We have so much to shout about. That's why my focus is to collaborate with government, the council and you, wherever possible, to make the island an even better place to live, work and learn.
And another view is from Emily Scotcher. I'll share my genuine passion for island life. Well, this is something a little different for me. Being asked to join the team of columnists feels like a return to my journalistic roots in a way. An English graduate that started out freelancing for a couple of local and national publications post-graduation, I then worked full-time for the county press from 2012 to 2014 and have since jumped into review the occasional theatre show when we needed it. It's good to be back in a different capacity. As a firm believer in writing about what you know and in what you've experienced, it will come as no surprise to anyone that a lot of my columns will focus on the island as a place to live and work, and no surprises here on its theatre and event scene. I've always passionately championed the island. I was born here, raised here, and returned here after university. And whilst that doesn't always equal a success story in the minds of many, but that's for another time. It feels like a success story to me. Don't get me wrong, the island isn't perfect. Where is? But it's home. It's somewhere that was always going to draw me back in, not because I think I couldn't have made it in a big city somewhere, but because over the years I've realised that making it doesn't mean you have to hit the big time in whatever field you're pursuing, or being monetarily rich, or being remembered a century from now. Making it, for me, has instead become synonymous in making whatever difference I can on my doorstep and with finding happiness in the people, places and pursuits that bring me joy. If people know me, it's often from one of two places. They've either come across me in a professional capacity as a commercial property agent, wrestling with keys and alarm codes, or they've seen me singing, dancing on stage. What always raises a smile for me, though, is how often work and play collide. Whether that's someone poking their head around a dressing room door to ask a property question while I'm sporting a red wig or fake tattoo, or whether more frequently someone is staring at me in a meeting with a look that says either something's stuck in my tooth or they're trying to work out how they know me. It's not long before everyone present is aware I have recently been painted green as an ogre princess, fighting a jewel covered in prosthetic scars, or flying a magic car. The other thing that really sparks me in this island itself, its scenery, its people, and frankly, astounding array of locally driven and homely events. Give me a jigsaw festival where I can rescue jigsaws with pieces missing, a midsummer fair where I can throw wooden balls at shelves of crockery, or cradle a Pimm's while watching country dancing or a falconry display. A horticultural show where I can quietly critique an array of pumpkins, even though I've never grown a vegetable in my life, and send any houseplant I own to an early grave. Give me island life. It is all collateral. Gentle, quirky glory, and will find me in a happy woman. So whilst my columns might not be filled with weighty convictions and matters for debate, they will hopefully give a peek into island life from the perspective of a 30-something making her way here, smattered with opinions, antidotes and experiences, and above all, a genuine passion for home.
We now have readers' letters. Birdsong Joy from Andrew Matthews of Wellow. The Brystone Forest is a mecca for bird life and a star attraction for keen ornithologists. On my usual early morning stroll with my dog at 6:30 a.m., I activated my Merlin Bird app and was thrilled to discover the following range of bird life, totaling 15 in all. Eurasian wren, Eurasian blackbird, song thrush, European robin, common wood pigeon, great tit, blue tit, common firecrest, coal tit, common chaffinch, ringneck pheasant, Eurasian tree creeper, redwing, chiff-chaff and grey wagtail. What a pleasure it was to immerse oneself in the natural peace and tranquility of this special island hideaway.
Dinosaur Island by Edward Lyon Sandown. With the local election, I very much hope we get some councillors intelligent enough to ban the killing of weeds using environmentally deadly spray, etc. When I heard it was still being used, I was appalled. I thought we were an eco-island. What uncaring, primitive dinosaur gave the go-ahead for the continued use of that? I know we are also known as Dinosaur Island, but I thought they died out years ago. There are less dangerous alternatives now available. Surely, for safety's sake, of our tourists and residents and wildlife, Eco Island should use them.
Good experience of care at hospital from Jim Kerr of Freshwater. I'd like to extend my thanks to the eye department at St Mary's Hospital. A foolish misadventure with some glue resulted in a referral to Newport Specsavers. An extremely thorough examination there proved fortuitous and demonstrated the best of joined-up healthcare. Glue was harmless, but exam revealed a significant retinal tear, and a call was immediately put through to the hospital. This was at approximately 3 p.m. Before 5 p.m, I was sitting in St Mary's refectory with a reviving cup of tea following emergency laser surgery. Care was truly a team effort, delivered with good humour, efficiency and expertise. We are truly blessed by our tireless NHS staff, and I have a good mind to restart banging my pot lids on a Thursday evening. Thanks for all that you do.
Not in favour, from Richard de Cabrec, Gurnard. Once again, Richard Altrincham of East Cowes have been rushing into print. The 1st of May 2026. This time bemoaning hold-ups by Red Funnel. He usually moans about Red Funnel, White Link and even old boys like me bathing in nostalgia and hampering progress on the island. He also continues to extol the virtues of a fixed link, bridge or tunnel to the island. What benefits did a fixed bridge bring to the Isle of Skye? Does he realise the sheer magnitude of a civil engineering project involving a bridge, not to say the cost? It's a wonder the island survived during the war, when one had to hold on Isle of Wight Pass to travel to and from the island because of its strategic importance. For the cost of a bridge, Red Funnel and White Link could renew their fleets a couple of times before the end of the century. Apart from this, think of the opportunities for grey squirrels to migrate here a fixed-lit bridge would provide. To conclude, please, Mr. Altrincham, don't get too intense about connectivity and try to enjoy some of the good things the Isle of Wight has. And so that's goodbye from me, Susan.
And it's goodbye from myself, John.
Have a good weekend.
This week's In Touch programme and the Scaffolding and Skips news follows.
Hello. Video games have long been a favourite pastime, evolving dramatically since the days of what's regarded by some as the first video game, Tennis for Two, in the late 1950s. A real 50s feel about that, isn't there? Yet, while the technology has surged forward, accessibility hasn't always kept pace with it. Now, RNIB is calling for regulation to tackle the inconsistencies and, in some cases, the complete inaccessibility faced by some visually impaired gamers. To tell us more is John Patton. John is the RNIB's Media, Culture and Immersive Technologies Manager. Also, we're joined by Ben Breen, Access Consultant, Content Creator and Accessible Gaming Officer at the RNIB. John, if I can start with you, what exactly is this white paper calling for?
So We're interested in what accessibility legislation existed. So we had a look across the UK, the US and the EU, because we thought those were the main kind of territories. We found there's some accessibility legislation, but it's all a bit kind of disparate, it's a bit uneven, and it doesn't really do the job well. So we then kind of looked at what good regulation could look like. And we think that could be much more of a collaborative thing. It could help the industry build up accessibility rather than just kind of slap on the wrist for getting it wrong. And we kind of end up looking at what else contributes to kind of mature accessibility ecosystem. So what developers can do, what industry bodies can do. And we end up with kind of recommendations for kind of all parties or stakeholders.
Can you give us an example of the sort of things you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's things like the software that developers use to create games. If those were designed in such a way that it was easier to build accessibility in, then that could really make a big difference. We've seen it before with mobile phones. So across Android and iOS, once you had accessibility APIs in there to make it easy to make your apps accessible, there was a huge, huge difference. Changing culture around accessibility, seeing it more as an innovation rather than a kind of add-on at the end. And just generally changing the culture and changing how people see it.
Are we actually talking about minimum standards? You know, the kind of thing that we've come to expect with audio description and the amount that television companies, for example, have to provide. Are you going to try to create realistic standards which people have to adhere to? And if so, who would make sure that they did?
I think that would need to be part of it. There are some things that you can look to and say those would make good minimum standards, things like subtitles, which now you couldn't put out a game without subtitles because everyone would say that this just isn't right. But then things like menu narration, there are definitely things that you can say should be in all or almost all games. We'd like to see how well the legislation could be crafted to see whether it can go much further than that, see whether there's ways to get as much utility out of it as possible.
Well, it's a question of will, isn't it? It's a question of how much you ask for.
Yeah, and the other thing about gaming is that all games are different. There's such a wide variety. So there's definitely going to be quite a challenge in kind of crafting some meaningful regulation that can cover the whole of gaming. If all it comes down to is minimum standards, if you have a game, this game should include X, Y, and Z, then that would still be progress.
I was going to say, that would be a start, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We have seen some good examples of how games can be made accessible for blind and partially sighted players. Games like Spider-Man 2 and Forza Motorsport, for example. But there is a lack of consistency, isn't there? Why is that? What are the barriers? Because you'd think if one or two companies could do it, they could all do it.
When we asked developers back in 2022, the things that came through was that overwhelmingly people told us they wanted to improve accessibility, but they didn't know how they could prioritise it. They didn't feel that they could start from the get-go looking at things to be accessible rather than getting the game out and then going, okay, how can we make this so other people can play it as well? So there's definitely interest there, but I think it's kind of lack of knowledge.
Well, does there need to be changes in the law? I mean, why doesn't the Equality Act go far enough in this case?
The Equality Act can only deal with services, and there's a lot of confusion about whether games are a goods or a service. And also, the Equality Act talks about reasonable adjustments. But when you look at other areas, if you look at broadcasting, for instance, Ofcom is able to provide advice on how to make things accessible. And so that kind of regulatory approach, more collaborative, working with industry rather than just telling them when they've got it wrong, we think could really make a difference.
Let me bring in Ben Breen. We spoke with you last about gaming accessibility back in 2023, I think, on the programme, when the RNIB launched the Design for Every Gamer campaign. Now, that was a sort of rallying cry to the industry to do better for visually impairment accessibility. 3 years later, we're talking about a white paper calling for regulation. Is the industry just not listening?
I don't think it's fair to say the industry isn't listening. I think the industry is listening, but the industry is in a very tough position at the moment, you know, given the amount of layoffs we've seen, for one thing, and, you know, how accessibility is prioritized. It's a very odd place to be in. I think we have seen improvements. We're seeing, you know, award shows recognizing accessibility. We're seeing, you know, the increases in the uptake, I think, from, you know, smaller scale developers to an extent. And these things take time.
So have there been developments that you have been excited about recently, or developments to come? Give us some hope.
Yeah, well, there's been an interesting rise, thanks to a rather divisive topic, which is AI, or artificial intelligence. There's been an interesting rise in accessibility mods or modifications that have been written for games that have existed for decades, some of them. But these have been put together by people with the assistance of AI, allowing games to be played that otherwise would be completely off limits. And it's allowed massive franchises to be at least partially opened up, if not fully, to, you know, to varying extents. And that's been amazing to see, partly because those mods might then provide insight to developers as to how they could make certain mechanics work, or maybe certain concepts, those kinds of things. You know, to John's point about developers are saying, we don't know how to do these things.
I mean, can you give us a couple of examples of where this has happened?
Yeah, so in terms of games that have been around for decades, the Final Fantasy series, the first six games of that have mods in various stages of completion that will allow you to, I believe, beat the entire game. I've heard of people beating whole games that otherwise they would never be able to play.
Of course, there are always some risks with using AI. We can't.
No, of course. Yeah.
We don't seem to be able to mention AI without mentioning risks. So what do you think could be the possible pitfalls of using it in this way?
I think one of the risks is potentially that there may be people who might see that and say, oh, we don't need to add accessibility in. That's a discussion point that's been raised before. You know, just because somebody can go in and mod it in themselves, now we don't have to do it. I will always advocate that native accessibility is the best way forward, because then if a developer does it in one project, they can add things into their next project based on the accessibility work they've already done, rather than just relying on the community. Because, you know, you should never just rely on people to fix your game for you, or make it better, or however you want to look at it. That's, you know, one of the potential risks. And of course, the other thing is the financial viability of it. It is not sustainable. You've got people paying exorbitant amounts of money to put these mods together with the assistance of AI. But, you know, that's not going to last. And so native accessibility needs to be at the forefront of these discussions, even if you're using AI created mods as a sort of an ideation engine to say, oh, this mod did this thing really well. Can we do this in our actual game, kind of thing? That's one way to look at it.
Just to personalise this a bit more, Ben, you live stream online while playing under the handle Sightless Combat. What methods do you use to find out if games are playable to you as a totally blind person before you spend your hard-earned money on them?
Admittedly, sometimes I will, you know, get codes for review to then be able to disseminate the information myself. So I will get a code in advance of launch, for instance, and then be able to say to people that I've played it, that it's accessible or not, as the case may be. Sometimes I will read social media. I will hear about games from other people. I will hear about games from conferences, that kind of thing. And sometimes I will end up looking at various sites that have been put together over the years, you know, including but not limited to Can I Play That, where they have accessibility reviews, or a new contender in that space, Able to Play.
Well, Ben, thank you for that. You've made my job easier, because this gives me the opportunity to bring in Arman Nabari, who's founder of Good Trouble, and they're a games technology company, and they use tech to make access to games more accessible, among other things. And they are the creators of that free platform called Able to Play. Arman, just explain a bit more about what you do.
So Able to Play matches gamers to games based on their personal accessibility needs. It sort of takes the stance that there is no one-size-fits-all monolithic definition of what accessibility is. You know, my needs might be different than Ben's needs, which might be different than your needs. And it lets players plug those needs into a completely private and encrypted profile, click one button, or use, you know, screen reader, NVDA inputs if they're, you know, prefer to interact with the site that way. Click a button, and then it re-ranks a huge library of thousands of games that we've painstakingly analyzed to give you a personal score to show you how accessible one game is versus another game for you specifically.
So can you just tell us a bit more about how your accessibility assessments work? You know, we've seen a number of studios launch games and announce their access features beforehand, but that can't be said in a lot of cases. So how do you know if someone will be able to play it?
Yeah, so we have an amazing team that will go and buy a copy of the game, run it through a methodology that we've developed over the last few years, literally play it, you know, look deep into not just the story, the presentation, the UI, of course, the settings, but also a lot of accessibility is not, you know, tucked away in a settings menu. It's often the core design of the game. These, you know, really nuanced attributes of what the game feels like to play and how that changes depending on your input, you know, if you're able to see the screen, if you're able to hear the audio. So we analyze it. We have a team of folks that have a very wide range of lived experience and different experience with disabilities. And we compile those findings, and then we just make it very, very easy for people to search and find what works for them.
Can you give us an idea of numbers? I've sort of used vague terms like, you know, large numbers of, but I mean, how many games and platforms are you able to test in this way?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been at this for years, and there's thousands and thousands of games on the platform across all different genres. And, you know, we have all of the main sort of primary consoles and devices on the site right now. And a goal for us, you know, sort of this year and looking ahead is, you know, we want every game that's ever been made to be on the site. We want it to be this deep repository where anyone can ask a question about any game's accessibility, past, present, or the goal is future, and be able to have those questions answered.
So this is not just about successful games. You list and mention all the inaccessible ones.
Oh, absolutely. And here's why. So playable might come down to one or two specific qualities for you or me or anyone. And you might not need to deeply concern yourself with the large swath of, you know, most of the features and accessibility attributes. You might just be looking for one or two things. If a game is largely inaccessible, but it has those one or two things, then it's accessible to you. And that's sort of the stance that we've taken is we want to help people find what works for them.
So it's totally personalized, yes. Basically.
100% personalized, yes.
Right. And Armand, I want to ask you this, because we started in a slightly depressed state of mind, sort of talking about, you know, the numbers of games that weren't accessible. You have access to all this information. Where do you think we are in terms of accessibility?
Oh, I love this question. So I'll preface this by just saying, when you look at the data, there's real genuine signs that we are approaching what you could describe as a renaissance of accessibility. And some of the advancements in just general technology and AI are, of course, to thank for that. But also, just the general population now has significant enough vocabulary that we can discuss accessibility. And most people, statistically, either have experienced or know someone who's experienced a disability in their life. When you zoom out, you know, the data that we're seeing is about one in three gamers are seeking out accessibility-related features regardless of their disability status. Businesses are also really becoming wise to the economics of having accessible products. Just to quantify that, people with disabilities are the third largest market demographic on Earth. And when you consistently look at the market-leading products, they are consistently the most accessible products in their category. So I think we're heading in a really, really bright direction.
Staying with you, Armand, talking about the way that this is extended, it seems odd in a way that we're talking about national barriers here, you know, what you can do in the UK. Surely now, with the way that this communication has gone, it goes worldwide, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If someone is making a product and that product is being sold or reaching people worldwide, they have an enormous incentive to consider the needs of different accessibility interpretations, considerations, what have you. Regulations are amazing to showing, you know, long-standing stair steps through history. But as we've, you know, seen in any market, markets tend to move faster than regulations. And, you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, largely the most successful products in any category are deeply considering the needs of, you know, users with different accessibility needs.
Right. And so, John, if I can just come back to you, I mean, listening to that, is that encouraging in the broader sense? And what are the next steps for the white paper?
Absolutely encouraging. And it sounds like a fascinating resource as well. We know that...
Do enough people know about that?
Well, I don't know. I was just about to say it's
more
one of the big
now,
questions.
More
do now, yeah. But it's one of the big questions people ask us when they come to us. I mean, you get all sorts of things, but the number one question is, I have sight loss, what can I play? So this is absolutely needed, and it's brilliant to hear this kind of positivity about the direction things are going. The phrase there about the industry moves quicker than regulation. A few things move slower than regulation, let's be honest. But it's kind of needed to shore up, to kind of set that advancement. Yes, it would always be behind where the industry is, but it's kind of needed to kind of set that in stone and make sure that we don't step back. But I mean,
absolutely
brilliant to hear that positivity.
Well, good to end on a positive note. John Patton, Ben Breen and Arman Nobari in Washington, USA. Thank you all very much indeed. Just one other thing before we go. Next week, we have our first opportunity to put questions to the relatively new CEO of the RNIB, Simon Antrobus. And so do you. We'd welcome your questions and we'll put as many as we can to him. But speed is now of the essence. You can email questions to intouch@bbc.co.uk or leave a voice version of your question on 0161 836 1338. We'd also welcome your comments and experiences of accessible and inaccessible gaming. That's it from me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings. Goodbye.
Scaffolding and Skips News, week commencing 11th of May. Newport area, Litchfield House, Union Street, 66 St James Street, Specsavers High Street. Newport area Skips, 6 South View.
Ride area, 141 High Street, 77 George Street, Morrison's Daily, Union Street, and 52 Union Street. Ride area Skips, 14 Castle Street, 5 Nelson Place, 28 Dover Street, 37 Quarry Road, and 59 High Street, Bembridge.
Cows and East Cows area, 106 High Street, 15 to 16 Market Hill and 25 Clarence Road, East Cows.
Ventnor area, Ventnor Youth Centre, Victoria Street.
Sandown area, 52 Fitzroy Street, Alverstone Farmhouse, Main Road, Alverstone, Ferncliff Path, Sandown, and 'Tis the Season, 16 St John's Road.